Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say. It's all right. It's all right.
Hey, everybody. This is Eric Mann, the host of Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. I'm calling you from Bonn, Germany, the site of a United Nations preparatory meeting for the United Nations Climate Change Conference, which is going to happen in Paris in December of 2015. It's exciting. I'm here with Barbara Lott-Holland, the Associate Director of the Strategy Center and my longtime co-chair of the Bus Riders Union. And I'll tell you more about what's going on at the United Nations in a subsequent conversation. But right now, I'm excited to tell you that I had an article published in the Huffington Post, which, as a writer, does mean a lot. Apparently, I don't know if this is true, it got 5,000 likes. But in terms of the comments, it seemed to get every right-wing nut under the sun. We got 450 comments, but it's called trolling, where these right-wingers are all, I guess they're all in some kind of incestuous inbreeding group, but they've all lost their mental capacity anyway. And then they just text each other and say, hey, there's a leftist on. Let's go attack his article. But they have a lot of profound insights, like you're a nut, and blacks and Latinos should go to jail anyway, and, you know, all those wonderful things that this is beyond the right. This is like the really crazy right. So, contrary to the really crazy right, here comes the profound, brilliant left, which is me, reading my article from the Huffington Post, which came out on May 31st, 2015. And it's also cool, it says, Eric Mann, revolutionary, civil rights, anti-war, labor, and environmental organizer. So you don't wonder why the right didn't like me. So the name of the title of my article is called President Obama, No Cars, No Way in the U.S., No Tanks, No Way in the U.S. On May 19th, in front of Augustus Hawkins High School in South Los Angeles, on the 90th anniversary of Malcolm X's birthday, 100 black and Latino high school students, bus riders, security guards, hotel workers chanted, President Obama, no tanks in LA, no cars in LA. Initiated by the Labor Community Strategy Center as Fights for the Soul of Cities, we called on the president to end the Department of Defense's 1033 program that gives surplus military-grade weapons to local police forces all over the United States, including Los Angeles School Police Department, and to go to the December 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris with a front-loaded, verifiable, enforceable plan to cut U.S. emissions by 50% of 1990 levels by 2025, starting today. But how can 100 people talking about no tanks and no cars, no A, expect to get the President of the United States to make radical changes in national and international military and climate policies? Obviously, there's no guarantee. But the line between delusional and visionary can only be determined in retrospect, and we have a real plan to win. All great social movements begin with an unassailable and irrefutable moral argument. In this case, it's that the U.S. policies are burning up our own cities and the planet. Today, in every urban center in the U.S., black and Latino communities are under a permanent military siege by the police and surveillance state, with the express policy objective of beating back the revolutionary ideologies and achievements of the Great Revolution, what I call the two decades of the 60s, from the Montgomery bus boycott and the Bandung Conference of Non-Allied Nations in 1955, to the defeat of the U.S. invasion of Vietnam in 1975. The ruling language of counterinsurgency shapes why there are 2.5 million people in U.S. prisons, 1 million of whom are black, and 500,000 of whom are Latino. Ending the war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on gangs will never work until the U.S. ends its war on blacks and Latinos. The Defense Department's 1033 program gives tanks, rocket launchers, assault rifles, MRAPs, and M16 rifles to local police forces all over the country And the application form basically says if you want it, you can have it. The Los Angeles Unified School District has 61 M16s. And the Los Angeles Police Department has 1,600 M16s. The International Red Cross has called the M16 an inhuman weapon. But the goal is to shoot down protesting students, parents, teachers, community residents who rise up in anger, demanding radical changes in our society. I was just rereading my own book, Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, on the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And even though I wrote it, I was shocked to remember that 100,000 black people who were forced out of New Orleans were essentially herded together and surrounded by the military. And what did the military have? M16. So as the growing climate crimes develop in Los Angeles, the relationship between climate and the 1033 program is the more the climate deteriorates, the more people rise up, the more M16s the system thinks it needs. So we're calling on the Los Angeles Unified School Board and the Los Angeles Police and Sheriff's Department to relinquish all their weapons from the 1033 program and, quote, burn them, don't return them, since they can't be used on others inside or outside the U.S. Recently, the president announced, quote, modifications to the program that restrict some of the weapons and, yes, the tanks, and create administrative procedures for the use of other weapons. But the police have still allowed many lethal weapons from the program and can kill people with impunity, and then we'll deal with any sanctions after the fact. President Obama must end the 1033 program down to the last bullet. The president's climate policies so far have been marked by moments of inspiration, followed by lethargy and a lack of will. Nature is not impressed as we approach the 10th anniversary of the Katrina climate catastrophe. And the last 10 years of federal inaction in the face of deteriorating permafrost, floods, droughts, melting coral reefs, and extreme weather events as the U.S. fiddles as the planet burns. The 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference is a big stage world event where governments try to finally grasp the enormity of the rapidly escalated rise of the Earth and water's temperature towards 2 degrees Celsius and beyond. But spoiler alert, unless reversed, the conference is headed for a disaster because the ground rules of the UNCCC, that is to say the United Nations Climate Change Conference, unless reversed, allow each government to set its own policies, to have no mandate international inspections of emissions, and no penalties for noncompliance of goals that can't be verified in the first place. President Obama recently signed a climate agreement with the Chinese government, in which he pledged to cut U.S. emissions by 28% over the next 10 years. Many Beltway environmental groups have praised the president, while not challenging the vague nature of the commitment or the inadequacy goal of only a 28% reduction. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says that while he's not clear exactly what the president says, he clearly opposes it. So you have the Democrats being vague and the Republicans being reactionary. So as a social movement, we begin by setting the terms of the debate and hoping that one key demand from U.S. organizations can at least push the U.S. and the U.N. government into a debate about one clear and forcible demand. We are proposing that President Obama go to Paris with a plan to cut U.S. emissions from 1990 levels by 2025, starting now. Here's how we can do it. He can cut U.S. auto production and consumption by 50% immediately. Cut U.S. coal. He can cut U.S. gas, coal, all production and consumption by 50% immediately. He can support the Strategy Center's No Cars in L.A. campaign of dramatic restriction on auto use through auto-free zones, auto-free rush hours, auto-free days in every city in the U.S., and making a major investment in a 5,000-bus, zero-emission bus fleet running 24-7 and, yes, free public transportation, through direct transfers of funds from the military budget to mandated bus systems all over the U.S. the fiasco of the L.A. rail system and its raids on the L.A. bus system is the subject of the successful civil rights lawsuit we brought against the Los Angeles MTA. And the 2,500 new compressed natural gas buses we won were only a down payment on what is needed. This bus-centered system could be up and running now with dramatic expansion of buses on the streets in 18 months to 3 years. I am on my way, along with Barbara Lott Holland, Associate Director of Strategy Center to Bonn, Germany, for preparatory meetings of the United Nations Climate Change Conference, where we will be part of the broad governmental and NGO movement to make the Paris United Nations Climate Change Conference the greatest success possible. In that international imperative, the President should issue every executive order under the sun to radically reduce emissions and rally popular support around his proposals. But of course, here's where organizing and movement building come in. The 100 people at the rally are organizers, not spectators. We are going door to door in South Los Angeles with 2,000 lawn signs, with pictures of President Obama, no cars in LA, no tanks in LA. We're meeting with 100 new churches, labor unions, and community groups in the next 60 days, speaking at UCLA, USC, community colleges, and groups of liberal Democrats. We're reaching out to Black and Latino communities, civil rights and social justice organizations, teachers and janitors unions, and the environmental justice movement in every city in the U.S. to call for no cars, no tanks in Detroit, Philadelphia, Chicago, Houston, Ferguson, Harlem, Baltimore. They're excited about our call for the social welfare state, not the police state, the climate justice state, not the warfare state. And they want to join a national campaign whose demands can be fought for and won, strengthening our national movement. Now, all great campaigns start with an unequivocal moral argument, and as Frederick Douglass taught, making very clear demands on those in power. So President Obama must end the 1033 program now and put forth a plan to reduce U.S. carbon emissions by 50% of 1990 levels by 2025, starting now. Do you agree? If you do, then the No Cars, No Tanks campaign has already picked up one new organizer. That says Eric Mann, a veteran of the Congress of Racial Equality, Students for a Democratic Society, and the United Auto Workers, is the director of the Labor Community Strategy Center and its Fight for the Soul of the Cities campaign. He's the author of Playbook for Progressives, 16 Qualities of the Successful Organizer, and the host of KPFK Pacifica's Voices from the Frontline, your national movement building show. He welcomes comments at eric@voicesfromthefrontline.com. So, my friends and my fellow listeners on Voices from the Frontline, your national movement building show, this is Eric Mann. I'm actually sitting in a hotel in Bonn, Germany. I'm on the phone with Julian Lamb, who's one of the producers and technicians and engineers for Voices from the Frontline, who's recording it at the Strategy Center. We're going to be playing it on the radio show that you care about. And yes, I would love to hear your comments at eric@voicesfromthefrontline.com. I say it now. I'll say it for the rest of my life. It never gets old. All power to the people.
If you love the sun, it's where you come from, then you had better dare to seize the time. The time is now.
Hey, everybody. This is Eric Mann, your host of Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. On Saturday night, May 2nd, at the Radisson Hotel on Figueroa, right across from USC, we actually had the 26th annual political party of my own organization, the Labor Community Strategy Center. We've always had a great program, and this year, among other things, we did a version of Voices from the Frontlines live on stage for the first time. We had Shepard Pettit, a longtime organizer with the Bus Riders Union, Lisa Gay Hamilton, a wonderful actress, Barbara Lott Holland, the Associate Director of the Labor Community Strategy Center, Aris Anagnos, a Greek freedom fighter who's in his early 90s and is still a Greek freedom fighter. Laura Aguilar, a student at Manual Arts High School, and one of the leaders of the Strategy Center's community rights campaign. Alice Caputo Pearl, who is the newly elected president of United Teachers of Los Angeles. And Manuel Pastor, a professor at University of Southern California and a longtime movement person. It was pretty cool. We all sat around in front of 300 people and acted like just the seven of us and eight of us were talking to each other. We sat in these nice, big, comfortable chairs, and I ran Voices from the Frontlines just like as if it would be doing it on Tuesday at 4. So this is pre-tape and nicely edited, and we're going to play it in segments between some of my commentaries on the UN conference on climate change, the fight for the solar cities, the no cars in LA, no tanks in LA. So this is a segment from Voices from the Frontlines on May 2nd, and I hope you will enjoy it.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right. It's all right.
So, ladies and gentlemen, sisters and brothers, and have your attention. My name is Eric Mann. I'm the host of a radio show called Voices from the Front Lines. It's on KPFK Pacifica, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. And tonight, we're going to have Voices from the Front Lines as a real radio show. So, in the art of improvisation, we call this the Warriors of the Round Table. So, Shepard Pettit, Lisa Gay Hamilton, Manuel Pastor, Alice Caputo Pearl, Arison Agnos, Laura Aguilar, Barbara Lott Holland. Shepard Pettit, tell us about the Detroit Rebellions.
Well, I lived in Detroit for all of my life. I came here to Los Angeles, California in 1975. But I was there for that 1965 rebellion. And it started downtown. A prostitute was beaten by a white police. And so this brought on the riots. So what happened at that time, Governor Romney, or you heard of Mike Romney, that's his father, was the governor of Michigan. So the riot lasted about, well, it was 2 days. So the National Guards could not control it. The Detroit police couldn't control the riot. So President Johnson was the president at that time, so he called it a National Guards. And we had militants, you know, that were shooting back, you know, at the police. And it was more like an insurgency against the Detroit police. But anyway, I had to sleep on my floor for about maybe 4 nights because bullets were flying. And then the mayor of Detroit, I think it was Mayor Annie or whatever, he told us, he said, turn off your lights. Nobody, you know, keep their lights on because snipers are shooting. So I was hearing helicopters fly all over, you know, the sky. Bullets were flying here and there. And I had a very dear friend of mine named Manuel Quasby. He was killed right in front of some other black militants. You know, the two white policemen just shot him, I guess, to say, if we shoot him, we could shoot y'all. This is, you know, how we control black people. But anyway, I happened to look in the Detroit newspaper a week later, and I seen his name. And it really touched me, you know, that a black man, unarmed, is being gunned down by a police. But we must look at the Detroit riots. They had riots in New York, New Jersey, the Watts riots. And to end this, I recall Governor Romney of Michigan arguing on television with President Johnson. He was telling President Johnson, they had a debate, oh, you haven't sent in the troops, you waited too late, or whatever. And Romney said, well, I did send the troops, you didn't do your job. And I mean, this was a political battle between President Johnson and Governor Romney of Michigan. So I could say that when we're talking about civil disobedience, we're talking about revolutionaries, we're talking about people who are dealing with insurgency against the system. We can't we can change the system and we can change the issues, but as black people, black lives count. Thank you.
So Lisa Gay Hamilton, tell us about the influence of W.E.B. Du Bois and your mean teachers.
What?
You don't think it was going to be easy.
What do you want me to talk about? Repeat that.
When you did your one-woman show, you told me that one of your influences was W.E.B. Du Bois, and you also thanked your mean teachers for helping you.
Well, I think everyone in this room at some point in their life has experienced adversity. Someone telling you that you can't do something because you're a woman, because of your gender, because of your religion, because of your race. And I, like everyone else, experienced that. And I, like everyone else in this room, took that as a challenge to overcome and to achieve. And so as a young woman growing up on Long Island in a predominantly white community and wanting to do Shakespeare and wanting to do Chekhov and wanting to do Shaw, that wasn't quite what people expected of me. And so I was fortunate enough to have enough people tell me that I can't do it to really do it the way that I wanted to do it. And I feel like I've been able to do that. And so Du Bois and Paul Robeson and Robin D.G. Kelly and a whole slew of other people that I admire have influenced me to keep going and doing the kinds of work that I'd like to do.
How did you get exposed, though, to Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois on Long Island?
Believe it or not, and Robin and I were talking about this the other night, it was through radio, and it was through Gil Noble. literally, on WBLS 107.5 used to be a very, very political station as well as music. But they would play Malcolm X, they would play Farrakhan, they would play Malcolm, they would play everybody. And so that's how I got to know those people, Adam Clayton Powell. And so every Sunday we watched Gil Noble. That really is how I learned about Marian Anderson. I mean, that's how I learned my black history was through them. And so that sad that Gil has left us, but also sad that no one has really replaced him. I'm sure we all do applaud Tavis, but there's nothing like Gil Noble.
Makes me really want to appreciate voices more.
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
To have a show that you can be on now. Mm-hmm. Manuel Pastor, you're at USC, which for most of us is not a friendly institution. You're trying to straddle a very complicated dance, which is move yourself through academia, do really a serious research, but fundamentally you're a movement person. It's a contradiction, but how do you address it?
Thanks for wanting me to address the deepest and most personal issues in my life. That's, I did want to say that I love Eric Mann. There's very few other people, though, that would interrupt a party for a talk show, particularly on a night in which Mayweather and Pacquiao are fighting. Probably the only thing that could shatter multiracial unity in this crowd are divides about that fight. It's an interesting question. I decided to get a degree and become a professor, but got my degree in economics from University of Massachusetts Amherst Marxist Economics Radical Political Economy program, because I thought so often the economy is used as a tool against us and used as an explanation for why we can't do justice. And that never made much sense to me, because it always seemed to me when you treated people right, when people had opportunities to move ahead and realize themselves, that it was better for the economy, it was better for the society, and that's kind of the message I wanted to learn about and wanted to be able to pick up. It's an interesting struggle being in the university. The university is in a place of enormous privilege, but also responsibility. So what we've tried to do with the two research centers that I run and many of you work with them, the Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration and the Program for Environmental and Regional Equity, is to provide that kind of research that can legitimate the case that many social movement organizations are making about why we need to raise the minimum wage, about why we need to expand mass transit, why we need to end over-incarceration, and why we need to end this mass deportation system. So I think the academy and intellectuals definitely have a role to play, and you have a role to play to hold the university accountable. To hold the university accountable. And then I guess my dean will be listening. To hold the university accountable about making research that's actually relevant to social policy and social needs, but also to hold the university accountable as one of the largest employers and economic developers in this area, to hold them accountable as communities have through these community benefits agreements.
Alex Caputo-Pearl, it's a phenomenal victory for the movement that you've been elected president of UTLA. I think it's your second greatest achievement, and I think your first is being a public school teacher at Crenshaw High School. And the dedication, why did you stick it out so long? They didn't even like you, man. They try to kick you out. And what makes you get up every morning and want to do it?
Well, first, I appreciate being here, and thanks for inviting me, Eric. I got to know you and the Strategy Center 23 years ago. Wow. And received a ton of training, a ton of support, a ton of tools for analysis that really carried me through many, many years.
Thanks.
So what happens at the Strategy Center is pretty unique, I think, in LA and across the country. What teaching for 22 years in South LA, I mean, I was reminded actually of what helps one go through that. I mean, the joy of working with students and families. Channing Martinez is here, who I met when he was a ninth grader in 2001 in my class. And as a ninth grader, he read a piece that I gave the students about the Mothers of East LA and the organizing that they did. And he started to ask questions, started to sort of push other students to try to look at the reading in a particular way. And got involved in Coalition for Educational Justice and now is doing fantastic work with the Strategy Center. That kind of working with youth of all, from all different places, but with that kind of potential to become political leaders like Channing has become with organizations like the Strategy Center is a huge piece of what I think keeps all of the educators who have a vision for something different going. And now our challenge is how do we take what has been really a grassroots movement, a sort of patchwork grassroots movement among educators, among parents, among students, among organizations, and try to take that kind of momentum against racism, for racial justice, for educational justice, and actually infuse the teachers' union with that.
That's right.
Teachers' union has had traditions that are proudly and strongly anti-racist, but also the unions have also been pulled by the gravitational pull of a more conservative politics and a more narrow politics. And now our challenge, and we're taking it up with a lot of pride and with a lot of energy, is to turn the union into really a vehicle that can be a social movement union to be a part of that broader fight for racial justice.
When a group of us went into Newark, New Jersey, in 1965, 66, 67, with the Newark Community Union Project. And we lived and worked in the black community. And three of us, white folks, were trying to figure out the question of authenticity because we really felt we were part of that community, but we were trying to figure out what was our role. And we all became public school teachers. And I lasted 5 months because back then, revolutionary things were moving fast. So I asked the students if they wanted to learn about birth control because an eighth grader was pregnant already. And I they wanted to bring somebody from Virginia Military Academy, so I said, that's great, we should bring Stokely. And then they actually wanted me to tell the kids how to eat, you know, with manners. And I told them probably something, anyway. So the point was that they fired me, but here's what's interesting. 500 black parents came out to support me and said, if you don't hire Eric Mann back, we're gonna burn the whole school down. That's back in the day when, I'm serious. And it said the trial ended at 3 in the morning when the court stenographer's hand got bad. So there's a tradition of people going into the public schools and working with the masses and building the kind of revolutionary movements that we need. And for a lot of you out there who are doing either social service work or health clinic work and other things like that, it's a critical role to get people to come into the communities like the work that you and other people are doing. Now, my friend Aris and Agnos, a very heroic life that's still very much going on. How do you figure that you ended up starting in the Greek resistance, moving through El Salvador, Nicaragua, real estate insurgency, and ended up with Syriza?
Well,
you see, if you hang around long enough, right?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to say that the Strategy Center is a vital organization in the fight against the abuse of power. Because no matter what form it takes, essentially, our struggle is a struggle against the abuse of power. And of course, because of my long life, I fought Italian fascism, German Nazism, British imperialism, and American imperialism in Indochina and in Central America. And I'm delighted to report to you that the Greek people rose up again.
Yes.
And they're fighting against these miserable policies of austerity, which demands reducing the wages of people, demands reducing the pensions of people, which in turn creates terrible unemployment and a terrible economic crisis. So right now, the Greek government, which is represented by the Syriza party, which includes all kinds of Marxists, former communists, socialists, radicals of all kinds, is fighting with the conservative forces of the European Union to get rid of this austerity program. And the conservative forces in the European Union are trying to strangle that government, because that government, through all kinds of being forced to buy a lot of armaments and so on, got into deep debt and needs money to get out of that debt to revitalize the economy so they can repay that debt. So they're trying to strangle that economy and bring the Greek economy and that effort and bring back the conservative government. So that's the struggle that's going on right now and next week. And the struggle we do here, that the Strategy Center does, the struggle in Central America, the struggle in Greece is the same. And I congratulate you for your work, and I'm proud to be part of your work.
Just one more observation, because I didn't want it to sound rhetorical. The concept of burning things down was a very important image and reality in the 60s. And it is, as we know now, coming back. And the question of a president that calls people that fight back criminals and thugs, when in fact people are going to burn down something because they elected a black president, that didn't seem to work. They did vote, but they took away the vote. So we don't take away what people need to do. We don't criticize people's choices in a system that gives them none. So I just want to point out that I wasn't, when the parents said that, 2 months later, they did burn down the city. And a year later, there was a black school board that got rid of the school board that got rid of me. So things, I was only a minor figure in history, but it was one of those cause celebres where the community did rally around me because they were looking for somebody to fight for their own kids. So I just wanted to point that out. And Aris, I think that, you know, my one of my favorite things is all power to the long distance runners. And for a lot of you out there, take good care of your health, because we need you, and we need people to make really long-term commitments to this, because history has a lot of zigs and zags, and I'm very happy that you fought the fascists, I mean that, and you can be living to see the victory of a left movement in Greece. Laura Aguilar and you and Michael Davis and now Channing Martinez, I feel like I've known you for a very long time. I was shocked when you told me you were a senior at Manual Arts High School, because I really thought by now you were, I mean it, that you were a senior at some college. I've known you for a very long time by just watching your own development. One of the things I'm interested in is how much you love ideas, how much you love theory. Where do you get that desire to talk about global warming and capitalism and patriarchy, and what goes through your mind that makes you like to talk about big concepts?
I think that I really love both like storytelling, but I also love taking action. Haha, taking action. You know, because, and then when, I remember when you're talking about like big ideas, like we have lectures, so I learn about these things and I really do enjoy them. And then where does this love come from? I just want to know what's going on, because if we don't know our history, that's one thing they want to take away from us, right? So getting it back, I feel like I'm getting part of myself back. And then knowing why, though, like, if I know life is unfair because I'm a woman, because I get catcalled, okay, but then thinking about it's not just being catcalled, why is it? Talking about why do men feel that they have the right to do it? And then not talking about that, but talking about how does that relate to the U.S., right? How they need that sort of, they can't have a support system between males or females, or also the system will not be able to work, will not be able to function the way it's supposed to function, keeping us separate. All right, I'm always talking fast because I get really excited. Because when I remember when we talk about that, then you relate that to racism, right? And then it's interesting how that works in a similar manner, right? You have to have the minorities, right, against each other. And then you have to think about why is that? And how does that work relating to jobs, relating to what we eat? Because everything is so connected. And then at the same time that racism is sort of like, is happening, it's a real reality. And while sexism is a real reality, talking about ableism, talking about how, you know, all these things really connect, and these big ideas, my eyes feel like they're huge now because I feel like I'm seeing more, like, but at the same time, I'm feeling more. I feel like I need to do something. And then if I want to do something, I remember before when we had a meeting, I'd be like, they say, okay, this is going to be your demand. I'm like, no, let's demand more. But they're like, no, you have to think about it strategically, because realistically, you have to be able to know what are your limits. And then you have to know every single little thing, how it all relates to each other. And like ideology and actually doing something about changing, they're all related. And that's why I love learning more, because the more I learn, the more I get to see what piece is there, what piece is actually hidden that I need to eliminate, what actions I need to do on my day-to-day to end this system, right? White supremacy, to end sexism. There's so many like struggles out there. I want to mention all of them. There's always an LGBTQ struggle. Don't forget about them. You know, transgender people, they all relate, because if we all got along, it's not that we get along, it's because it's a system set up so that we can't, right? If I could do that, then I could bring peace. So I just need to know how.
I mean, one thing I just want to say is that revolutions are built on ideas. I mean, people don't really fight for material things. They really don't. Mm-hmm. They don't fight for stop signs. They don't fight for even a small class size. They fight because it's part of a view of changing the system. And that's what makes it exciting. We do need small classes. But we need young people like you who like the ideas. Channing is another one who enjoys trying to put all these pieces together. And thanks for being with us. Mm-hmm. Barbara Lahan, you did a, we met you on the bus, or you met us on the bus. You saved our life by, you know, everybody talks about how'd you meet Barbara Lahan. Well, I'm lucky I got to meet Barbara Lahan. You went from being, you and I have been co-chairs of the Bus Rising Union for about 15 years. And you now, along with Tammy Bang Liu, we have two associate directors at the Strategy Center, Tammy and Barbara. So you wrote an article for Aura Now called Life is a Consciousness-Raising Experience. You've come a long way, but what's your present struggle around consciousness?
A lot of things, but one main struggle I have, which really turned a corner during a retreat we had. You know, ever since when I came to the Strategy Center, I always heard the Black national question. We go to meetings, Black liberation meetings, even reparation meetings, and the Black national question. And during all of these talks and fighting for our rights, you know, we had the 20 acres and the mule. Did we have it? Do we have it? You know, are we truly now still slaves? What is the Black national question? But after 15 years in the Strategy Center and all of the studying and the fighting and the struggles that we've been through, I realized there is no more question, what is the Black national question? The answer is there is a Black nation in the United States. How long does it take us to figure that out? 300 years of transitioning, 300 years of struggling, or even before that, because we didn't just walk on the boat. We didn't walk into the bows of the boat. We struggled and fought every inch of the way. And so now that is the answer. There is a Black nation. What form does it take? What does it mean? What is the debt? It's too huge for the U.S. to actually repay. They can never repay the debt. But how is it that we make them accountable? How is it that we make ourselves accountable? How is it that we make our legacy accountable for the struggle that we are constantly going through? And now as we are moving forward, even within the Strategy Center, and we're looking at climate change, global warming, whatever it is that we want to call it, we know that there is definitely something happening to our planet. We know we've seen it in Katrina. We saw it in the storms in New York. We've seen what happened in the Black Islands, that when the natural or unnatural disasters, which are more human-made than anything else, where does that leave us? Where does that leave the Black nation and other oppressed nations within the U.S.? Do we sit idly by and watch it happen and not fight, knowing that we are on the front lines of it? How do we now galvanize our communities to fight back as we are going to the COP21 discussion in Paris and placing demands on our president, on our Black president, to say we want 50% reduction in emissions. We want it now, we want it completed, or started within the next 10 years, but starting now. Those are the struggles, those are the new questions that we are asking that's been here all the time.
Okay, now this is called the lightning round. It's like now 59 seconds and you're cut off, just like we learned from our friends at the MTA. I'm going to give you one heads up, but that's why I was going to have to go fast. The central book, film, poem, art that changed your life. Mm. Harris.
Well, of communications is something that will carry the ideas that will change society. And it's important to be clear in it that there is the, I mean, we have gotten to the point where 1% owns as much as, I think, the majority, or the other 90%. So we need to fight that kind of system, and we need to use communications and information and spread information, share information, and combat misinformation. Because from the days of Ronald Reagan, we have been inundated with fake information, false information that tries to turn some people against others and yet permit those at the top to just gather everything for their own benefit.
Okay, and a great book is that Aris is writing an autobiography, an amazing autobiography that we're going to help him. He already has 9 chapters written, so that's the book that I think is the most important. Lisa Gay.
I'm going to cheat.
Sorry.
And say that the most important person
okay.
that I know is Robin D.G. Kelly. And not just because I'm married to him. But I think he is the kind of extraordinary human being that talks about everything. He talks about art. He talks about global warming. He talks about war. He talks about Palestine. And he's always thinking about it. And to have him here, and I mean that in the biggest sense, he's someone that we have to read and follow and listen to. And
I love you too.
But I think he's we need him in the struggle.
We're very lucky, I mean, in the Strategy Center to have you, Lisa Gay, and to have you, Rob. And we're not your only affiliation, but we're really proud of the relationship. And there's so many great books. Victor Wallace, an old friend of mine, said, you got to read, when we were organizing on the buses, he said, you have to read this book called Race Rebels, because it documented all the struggles that took place, I believe, in Montgomery before Was it Montgomery? Documenting, but the way you do Robin's work is the attention to detail is phenomenal. Went and documented every complaint that a black person brought against the drivers and how many guns were pulled. Then you have to read Hammer and Hoe, which is an amazing book about a black communist organization in Alabama, which derails the concept that communism is European and white, and talks about the centrality of the black national question. Then you got to read Freedom Dreams, and we'll keep going. But Robin is unusually modest, but incredibly prolific, and we have to protect our own resources.
Yeah.
So, Manuel.
I'm going to cheat, but in a different way, but I'll stay within 60 seconds. So the most important book I ever read actually was Monopoly Capital by Baran and Sweezy, because it was the first time I understood capitalism as a system, and it sort of steered me to radical political economy and stripped away all the what traditional economics was trying to teach us, trying to brainwash us into not seeing. The most important intellectual I ever spent any time with was my dad, who was a guy who came to the United States as an undocumented immigrant, had a 6th grade education, but thought deeply and profoundly about the world and taught me that there was nothing so complicated that you couldn't understand it. And that's sort of what launched me into the world of being a professor. And the most amazing young intellectual I've met is you.
Wow.
So I just wanted to give you the official professorial statement. You go, girl.
Alex?
Book, one of them certainly, Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, which is very relevant for us right now. It's about the union movement, the black leadership within the union movement in Detroit, where workers actually were fighting for their workplace concerns and civil rights and racial justice at the same time. Very powerful book. Film, I would say Rabbit Proof Fence, which is an Australian film that mainly because I would show it every year in my classroom, and actually one of the reasons that they said they got rid of me at Crenshaw was because I showed that film. But it, more than any other movie that I've seen, it's an Australian movie about the treatment of Aboriginal people. Yeah. And I've never seen a movie affect high school students in the United States in the same way, of showing pain, torture, and resistance, and beauty and love at the end of a long resistance fight. It's an incredible movie.
It's beautiful. Shepherd Pettit.
I know the book you had written, Dispatch to Durban, when you That's went right. to South Africa, Barbara Woodrow. I didn't read all the book, but I read, you know, about the apartheid system in South Africa, and I said, you know what? That's the same apartheid system in the South, in the United States, you know? And I said, so that means that black people in South Africa are facing the same thing that the black people in the South are facing. Jim Crow laws versus apartheid in South Africa, because in South Africa, the white people owned all the land. And if you remember the history, the British and the Boer War, 1867, somewhere in there, the British won. And so in South Africa, they said Cape colored people. Now in the United States, they used to say, we were colored. Yeah, they said that colored boy. And then I soon realized in South Africa, when they said Cape colored, what's the difference? If you got one drop or two drops of black blood, you're black, you're an African. That's right. And so Mahatma Gandhi, you know, I read about that, you know, came to South Africa, but he was representing the Indian population. But it stuck in my mind. I said, you know, now South Africa, Nelson Mandela, he's facing the same, he's kind of like Martin Luther King, you know, a leader, you know, in South Africa, you know, and it really touched me, you know. I said, well, I didn't realize, or I wasn't conscious of that black people were facing that in South Africa, you know, apartheid system, segregation. Same thing in the South. So it really touched me, and it opened my mind up more, it touched my conscience. Thank you for writing that book.
That's very nice, Jeffrey. Wow, didn't expect that. Laura, and thanks, Shep.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, ever since I joined the organization, there's so many documentaries that the organization has showed me. There's so many books Thank you, Ashley Franklin, that we were exposed to, right? And then it's hard to choose, but I think one of the best documentaries that I really liked was Precious Knowledge, because, I don't know, because I'm Hispanic, I guess, and I could relate to it the most, because one of the things that they try to steal is your identity, right? And then thinking about how, I remember when I went to the march around LAUSD saying, you know, let us know our history, and then I was like, not much changes. In a way, it just, the system, how does it go? The system never ends, just changes form. So once you think you might have won something, it has won up on you. And then it's really interesting to see that, how that plays out. And then book, I really like the autobiography of Malcolm X, which I read before joining, which I think is why I joined, because my teacher told the class to read it, and then she forgot about it, but I still read it because I'm a bookworm. And then seeing how, again, history really doesn't change, but I remember how reading how the growth that Malcolm X had from being really being towards, you know, he's always about the black movement, right? But how he got more thinking about other people, not just the people that at first he really thought about. And then how I'm hoping that'll happen to me and I'll have growth. And then how, because I even remember when I first started, I was really hyper. Immature, I don't know how to say it, but I think that I grew from that, and that now my ideology lets me think of things differently and not just so narrow. So listen, that's the book and the movie.
Barbara, you get the next to last word.
Okay, well, one of the most important books that I read was W.E.B. Du Bois, Black Reconstruction. And a lot of it hurt me because it was a lot of pain and the struggle. And it also made me feel good of all the resistance that Black people have done, which is why we are still here. It is not because we laid down and let the system totally ethnocize us, but that we actually fought back. Many of us died, but we are here because we fought back, because we chose to struggle. One of the most powerful movies that I saw was Malcolm X, directed by Spike Lee, which was a double impressive to me that there was a Black man. Spike Lee's movies have always called the question. And it also showed the power that Black people had, especially those, especially during the time of Malcolm X, because it portrayed how powerful he was, how necessary it was for the system to get rid of him, and what everyday people, the power that they had. And I'm sure many of us saw that. And when you are getting people together that is in unison, that you can make a sign with your hand and everyone moves in unison. I mean, I trembled and I felt the power from it and knew that we had it in us. And that's the type of person that I wanted to be.
For me, the most formative book I ever read was Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, because it made me understand what I didn't understand. And when I was in Harlem with CORE, they said, the only reason we work with you is that you understand that you don't understand. And I have never assumed that I can fully grasp the totality of the Black experience, but it is the central challenge of my entire life, and it is where my loyalties are. It is where I will live and die. And that book changed my life. And the film that changed my life the most is The Battle of Algiers, because it showed that you really have to be willing to fight and die for your beliefs. I don't always live up to that, but I think that's going to be a challenge for a lot of us, is not just what do you believe, but what are you willing to do about what you believe, and what is the cost? And that film of Ali Lapointe and the people behind that door, knowing that, just like Maria Guardado, actually, you want to come out, or you want to stay in and we'll blow you up. And the pictures on their face of saying the Algerian people will never give in. That's why I still wake up in the morning wanting to do what I want to do. So I have to say, I had a little bit of an anxiety attack when I was thinking about this thing. It sounded like a great idea, but I was wondering how we would do, and I think it's been kind of mind-blowing for me to see, because I picked you all, you know, so I did get to cast this movie. And you are some of my favorite actors historically and people I really admire a lot. So this is Eric Mann on KPFK, 90.7 FM, saying, like Nina Simone says, here comes the sun, and as I end every show, it may be old, but it's still true, all power to the people.